Angie Maxted, also a doctor. I forgot to ask people's titles, so I'm waiting for their titles to come up on their slides so I can appropriately accredit them. She's going to talk about public health response to an imported case of canine melioidosis. Sorry, New York, 2016.
Hi, good afternoon. So this story involves a 4-year-old mixed breed dog that was partially paralyzed in its hind limbs and had urinary incontinence. The dog had previously spent 21 months in an animal shelter in Thailand after it had suffered a spinal injury. The dog had been adopted and imported by an animal rescue organization in New York. Overnight on April 19th into the 20th, 2016, it arrived by air at JFK Airport and then was driven to the rescue organization's property in Broome County, New York. On the next day, the dog went to a veterinary teaching hospital, I'll let you guess which one, for evaluation and fitting of a mobility assistance cart, such as the example in the picture. Except for the paralysis, the dog appeared healthy and behaved normally. But because of the urinary incontinence, a workup included a cystocentesis for urine culture. The dog at that time was prescribed an oral cephalosporin for inguinal pyoderma. 8 days later, the dog returned to the vet hospital to receive its cart. The urine analysis was normal except for large numbers of an organism that the vet hospital lab identified as a Burkholderia species. Our public health lab and the CDC subsequently identified the organism as Burkholderia pseudomallei. At this time, the antibiotic was switched to fluoroquinolone. B. pseudomallei causes the disease melioidosis. It's a saprophytic, aerobic, gram-negative bacillus that's normally found in soil and surface water. The range of melioidosis is on this map. It's mostly found in tropical and subtropical areas, but particularly in Southeast Asia and Northern Australia, where it's considered highly endemic. Infection usually occurs through contact, inhalation, or ingestion of contaminated soil or water. Person-to-person, perinatal, and zoonotic transmission have been described. Infections occur more commonly in the raining season, during flooding events, and in persons who have occupational exposures to soil and water, such as rice farmers. Laboratory exposure is also a concern. Melioidosis is rare in the U.S. There are just a handful of human cases annually, and these are almost always acquired overseas. Diabetes, chronic kidney or liver disease, and immunosuppression are risk factors. Disease can manifest in many forms, including bacteremia and sepsis, pneumonia, cutaneous infection, and solid organ abscesses or granulomas. Sometimes the disease can become chronic or recurrent. The incubation period is typically a few weeks, but it can be longer. Treatment involves a prolonged course of IV antibiotics followed by oral antibiotics out to 3 to 6 months. Even with treatment, relapses can occur. The case fatality is reported to be 15 to 40%, depending on several factors, including the promptness of recognition and treatment initiation. Melioidosis can be found in many animal species, including mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish. In endemic areas, incidence is higher in sheep, goats, camelids, swine, and deer, and lower incidence in other species. Melioidosis has been imported into the U.S. previously in research primates and also a couple of iguanas, but there have been no U.S. canine cases since the Vietnam War era when it was imported in military working dogs. Clinical disease manifestations in animals are variable and are similar to those in humans, and subclinical infections are reportedly common. Treatment of animals is rarely attempted, but when it is, the regimen is similar to that in humans. However, treatment can be unsuccessful, and the optimal treatment regimen for animals is not known. Treatment is more often attempted in pets that are affected rather than livestock. In the U.S., melioidosis is a foreign animal disease, and B. pseudomallei is a select agent. The goals of the public health response to this finding were to identify any persons or animals at risk, to offer recommendations for follow-up, to prevent any further human or animal exposures, and to prevent local soil and water contamination. And there were two local health departments in New York involved. One part of the response was investigation at the rescue operation. This was essentially a home and a small farm that served as an animal sanctuary and was also actively involved in adoptions. At the time of the site visit, there were 135 animals present here, including dogs, cats, livestock, horses, songbirds, and poultry. The operation was described as well-kept and well-run. The owner-operator customarily isolates newly arriving animals, and the dog had been housed in an indoor isolation room since its arrival. Upon hearing of the diagnosis, the owner had already implemented infection control measures, including continued isolation, placement of a bleach foot bath at the entrance to the room, limiting contact to a single caregiver, use of latex gloves, using double diapers on the dog to collect urine, and burning these diapers after use, and use of environmental cleaning with bleach. There are published guidelines for laboratory exposures, which can be divided into low-risk and high-risk exposures. I won't go through all of this, but you can see some of the example scenarios and the recommended follow-up for both low-risk and high-risk exposures, which can include symptom and fever watch, serologic monitoring, and for high-risk exposures, antibiotic PEP. At the rescue, we weren't entirely sure of the relevance of the published guidelines for laboratory exposure, so we sought expert opinion from CDC experts. We were most concerned about direct contact to the dog's urine because it was known to contain a high level of the organism. In all, 6 persons were evaluated, and 3 of these had direct skin exposure to the dog's urine. None of the exposed had underlying health conditions, and all were determined to have low-risk exposures, if even that, probably lower than low. All 3 persons were provided education, and their physicians were contacted. They also self-monitored for fever and symptoms, and a baseline serology was taken for comparison in the event that they would become ill. And there ended up being no animals exposed at this location. Contacts were also assessed at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital. And to give you an idea of size, there's more than 1,400 persons affiliated with the college and more than 22,000 companion animals that visit annually. There were 27 persons assessed for exposure risk here, and it was determined 11 had no exposure, 14 had what they classified as low-risk exposure, and 2 were at high risk related to an underlying health condition. Of the 16 exposed, 4 were laboratories and 12 were clinical personnel. 6 of the 16 accepted the fever symptom monitoring by the local health department. 3 of the 16 accepted baseline and sequential serologic monitoring, and 1 of the 2 high-risk contacts accepted the PEP, antibiotic PEP. And there were no animals exposed here either. So the outcomes, because of the dog's housing situation in the shelter, and given that treatment could be unsuccessful and the treatment regimen wasn't known, the dog was humanely euthanized at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital. No necropsy was performed to limit the possibility of future further exposure to staff. The dog's remains were disposed by alkaline hydrolysis. Because this is a select agent, the federal select agent regulations were considered in the transport and disposal decisions, as well as input from our Ag and Markets Department. Of the human contacts, there were no reported illnesses. Some of the people who had potentially very low risk exposure chose no follow-up. One contact had a serology double to 1 to 40 at week 4, but this was equivocal and non-actionable. The WEM PEP course was uneventful. Also notified were the CDC's Division of Global Migration Quarantine, because the dog had traveled by air, and also the shelter in Thailand, and they had reported that they had no human or animal illnesses there. So of lessons learned, there was prompt action and the already good isolation and quarantine procedures implemented by the rescue organization meant that we didn't have any further spread to humans or animals, and soil contamination was avoided. Even though that New York is too cold for the organism to persist over the winter, we were very glad to hear that the dog had not spent time outside. Of course, in veterinary medicine as well as human medicine, international travel history is important, and it would be impossible to prevent all disease importations through animal import regulations. This investigation was used a One Health approach and involved multiple jurisdictions with consideration for the well-being of humans, animals, and the environment. And it also highlighted the importance of pre-existing local health department relationships with veterinary facilities and animal owners. Thank you.